Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
You can't tell me that it says nothing about his priorities, that it says nothing about the attitude of his heart. But then even more, you have to say, what does it say about us today? What are our cathedrals? What are the greatest buildings that we make in our culture today? Greatest buildings? Amusement parks, shopping malls, sports stadiums.
Solomon spent more time building his own house than he did in building the house of the Lord. This says something about his priorities. But in today's message, Pastor David challenges us about our culture and what we spend most of our time and effort on. What are our greatest buildings? Years ago, churches were the grandest buildings in Europe and America. Today, they've been replaced in splendor by sports stadiums, amusement parks, and shopping malls. What does this say about our priorities? Now, here's Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
That you are in the throne room of God, and the cherubim, which actually and in fact surround the throne of God, were artistically pictured around you. And there, symbolizing or indicating the throne of God behind the veil, was the Ark of the Covenant itself. But inside, you would see gold all around and the artistic representations of cherubim. Now, when you think of cherubim, don't think of fat little babies with wings. This is a medieval conception of what a cherub is. These were glorious, fearful creatures. The Bible has a hard time describing them to us. They seem to represent the glory of all creation. The excellence of every kind of created being is summed up within the cherubim. And these beings do nothing morning, noon, and night except worship God and honor him around his throne. But as it says, and the floor of the temple, verse 30, he overlaid with gold. You walked into the temple and it was gold everywhere. An absolutely amazing building. Verse 29 tells us, he carved all the walls of the temple all around, both the inner and the outer sanctuaries, with the carved figures of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. And then it says in verse 36 about building the inner court. Again, the temple also had courts outside the actual building. There was the great court where the people came to pray. Outside of it was the court for women. And then outside of that was the court of the Gentiles. You must always be remembered that under the Old Covenant, the temple was not only for the people, or it was not for the people of Israel. The temple was for the priests of Israel. You, a common Israelite, if you were one back in those days, you couldn't just walk into the temple and say, hey, I'd love to see the place. You know, when do they have the tour? When are the tour times of the temple inside? Yes, may I take pictures inside here? Well, yes, but no flash or something like that. You couldn't do that in those days, of course. The temple was not for the people, it was for the priests. The courtyards around the temple, those were for the people. Verse 38 tells us that it was, in the 11th year in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all its details and according to all its plans, so he was 7 years in building it. When the temple was finished, it was a spectacular building. Absolutely spectacular, perhaps one of the most glorious buildings on the earth at that time. And of course, having such a spectacular building as the temple, it provided a great temptation to Israel. It was possible for them to focus upon the temple of God instead of upon the God of the temple. You see, what made the temple glorious was a good relationship with God. Without that good relationship with God, the glory of the temple would soon fade. The glorious temple of Solomon was plundered. It wasn't destroyed, but many of its glorious pieces were removed just 5 years after his death. Do you see how glorious it is described here? It didn't last long. Now, I'm not saying that it turned into a piece of junk. It wasn't a terrible place, but there was a definite step back in the glory of the temple just 5 years after the death of Solomon. And so it's sobering to consider that, isn't it? that these things man makes, it's very easy for things to become idols in our mind. I think about it in particular in the days of Jesus. You know, in the days of Jesus, there was a great idolatry of the temple. It could be argued that the temple that Herod made, if you want a quick history of the temple, Solomon built this temple. It existed for, 300-400 years, and then it was destroyed by the Babylonians. After 70 years, Ezra and a group of godly people, a small group of those who had been carried away to Babylon, came back to Jerusalem, and they rebuilt the temple. And it was a humble building compared to Solomon's. There's a very gripping, it's a very poignant place there in the book of Ezra, where it describes the dedication of the temple that Ezra built with the returning captives. And it says that the young men rejoiced. They were so excited that here was the temple, and we've got a temple, and we never saw a temple in our whole life, and here's one in Jerusalem. But it says that the old men wept because they remembered how great the former temple had been. And so Ezra rebuilt the temple, but they didn't have much money. It wasn't built with gold. It was built with plastic or whatever the ancient equivalent of it was. You know, they did the best they could. God was honored by it, but it wasn't Solomon's temple. And this ached in their heart. Then came King Herod. And Herod was an ambitious man, not a Jew, an Idumean, and a descendant of the Edomites. And Herod had on his heart to build a building more glorious than Solomon, and you might say that he even succeeded. And this temple, as it was in the days of Jesus, which is commonly called the Second Temple or Herod's Temple, was actually a renovated Ezra's temple. It was the same basic building as Ezra's, but man, did he renovate it. Did he add on to it? He made it glorious. And that was the temple that existed in the days of Jesus. And it was very much an idol in the minds of the people of Israel. But here at the end of verse 38, you have this glorious finishing of the temple. And you can just almost see it in your mind. They're up on the Temple Mount. They're beautiful, glistening with the marble and the gold and the beautiful courtyards and the priestly offerings and all the rest of it. But it wasn't just about building the temple. There were also other things that needed to be built. And that's concerning here chapter 7, verse 1. But Solomon took 13 years to build his own house, so he finished all his house. Whoa, do you catch a little bit of a disconnect here? A little bit of a problem between chapter 6, verse 38, and chapter 7, verse 1. How many years did it take to build the temple? It took 7 years. How many years did it take to build Solomon's house? 13 years. Now, the temple was glorious. But the idea that we seem to have from verse 1 of chapter 7 is that Solomon wanted a house that was more glorious than the temple. You can say that Solomon finished the work of building the temple, but he wanted something even more glorious than that in his own house. And isn't it interesting? We're going to come up to chapter 11 in several weeks, and we'll find the very painful description of Solomon's last years. But don't you see little sprinkles of warnings throughout the life of Solomon? This is one of them. Verse 2. He also built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Its length was 100 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits, with four rows of cedar pillars and the cedar beams on the pillars. It was paneled with cedar above the beams that were on the 45 pillars, 13 to a row. There were windows with beveled frames in the three rows, and the window was opposite in three tiers. It goes on and on and on all the way through here, verse 12, describing this great palace that he made for himself and the different rooms or the different buildings of the palace complex, the house of the forest of Lebanon, the hall of pillars, the hall of judgment, all these different places. It's interesting that they called it the House of the Forest of Lebanon. So much magnificent cedar wood from Lebanon was used to build Solomon's palace that they called it the House of the Forest of Lebanon. You walked into that room and it was like walking in the Forest of Lebanon. That's all you saw was beautiful cedar everywhere. And they had 45 pillars, which would give you the idea of these great, great trees all around you. By the way, 1 Kings chapter 10 tells us that 500 golden shields were hung in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Isaiah chapter 22 calls this house an armory, a place where you stored armor. This was a spectacular building. And so were the inner court of the house of the Lord. It was an amazing, amazing place. It was used to describe the idea here. Well, look, let's just read verse 12. The great court was enclosed with three rows of hewn stones and a row of cedar beams. So were the inner court of the house of the Lord and the vestibule of the temple. Do you get the idea there? It's saying Solomon built his house. Oh, yeah, and they did some of those same things in the temple. The idea you're left with over and over again was that Solomon was more concerned with building his house and making his house glorious than he was with even making the temple of God glorious. You know, it's interesting, sort of backwards from his father David, wasn't it? David built himself a house, and then he said, oh, God should have a house. Let's make a temple. Solomon said, all right, we'll get the temple out of the way. Then I'm building my house. Quite a contrast, isn't it? You know, when you travel around today, go all over Europe today, and you'll find magnificent cathedrals. Do you like walking into those places? I do. We love to walk inside these old cathedrals and see the artwork and see the construction and see the amazing. I'm absolutely amazed at the technology and the construction that they used to build these wonderful, wonderful old buildings. It took incredible labor and cost to people who would never dream of living in such a spectacular place. The idea that somebody would live in a building that spectacular was completely foreign to people back then. You see, what they said in old Europe then was, our most magnificent buildings will be churches. That said something about their priorities. It said something about their heart. What does it say about Solomon's heart? That his own house, his own home, was a more spectacular building than the temple of the Lord. You can't tell me that it says nothing about his priorities, that it says nothing about the attitude of his heart. But then even more, you have to say, what does it say about us today? What are our cathedrals? What are the greatest buildings that we make in our culture today? Greatest buildings? Amusement parks, shopping malls, sports stadiums. Are these not the great buildings we make today? How much more wonderful it would be if people had a concern to make really amazing, glorious churches. I mean, I don't think I would want to go back to the days of cathedrals. And say, if you walk into those places, and the one thing I hate about those old cathedrals is you walk in there and almost every one of them, almost without fail, you realize these are horrible places for preaching the Word of God. The acoustics do not lend themselves to good preaching, to good speaking. Maybe beautiful music, maybe beautiful artistic demonstration. So I'm not saying we get back to building cathedrals, but make no mistake about it. The priorities of our modern culture are demonstrated by what we make our most glorious buildings about. And so were Solomon's priorities. Well, verse 13 begins this section describing some of the temple furnishings here. Now King Solomon sent and brought Huram from Tyre. He was the son of a widow from the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a bronze worker. He was filled with wisdom and understanding and skill in working with all kinds of bronze work. So he came to King Solomon and did all his work. Now this man was half Israeli and half Gentile. But isn't it interesting? It didn't matter to Solomon. He says, oh, no, no, no. We can only have pure Israelite blood building the temple. He said, no, no, no. You're the best man for the job. You come in and do the job. And that's how it was done in the building of what Solomon wanted to build. Verse 15, here are the different articles that were made for the furnishings of the temple. Now, matter of fact, this section here goes all the way from verse 15 all the way to the end of the chapter, verse 51, where it talks about the different articles that were made for the house of the Lord. For example, you can see here in verse 15, and he cast two pillars of bronze, each one 18 cubits high, and a line of 12 cubits measured the circumference of each. Then he made two capitals of cast bronze to be set on the tops of the pillars. The height of one capital was 5 cubits, and the height of the other capital was 5 cubits. He made a lattice network with wreaths of chainwork for the capitals which were on top of the pillars, 7 chains for one capital and 7 for the other capitals. Well, These very impressive pillars were actually so noteworthy, two great pillars in the temple, that they were given names. 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 17, mentions the names of these pillars, that they were called Yachin and Boaz. They were given names. Isn't that interesting? Yachin, the name means he shall establish. Boaz, the name of the other one, means in strength. I think it is significant. You walked into the temple, the first things you saw were Yachin and Boaz. And those were meant to remind them of something. The pillars were to be a constant reminder that he was to the king, that he ruled by God's appointment, by God's grace, and by God's strength. I think they were also meant to remind Israel of the two pillars that guided them through the wilderness. You know, there was a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day that led Israel through the wilderness. But I think that more importantly than maybe the pillars themselves were the names that they were given. You would walk up to the temple and say, look, there is he shall establish. And over there is in him is strength. Every time a person walked up to the temple, it put them in the right frame of mind to worship. When crowds gathered at the temple for the morning and evening sacrifice to worship the Lord, the Levites led the people standing in front of those two pillars, and the two pillars were, he shall establish, and in him is strength. You could almost say that of the temple of God itself, that it was Yachin and Boaz, that it was established by God, and that it was built by the strength of God. And of course, every time God met his people, that's what he wanted to give to them. He wanted to establish them in him, and he wanted them to give them strength. I think that is a glorious thing here. It's every time a church building is built, it'd be great if you had two pillars in front of this building here. Yachin and Boaz. But one that said, he shall establish. And the other one that says, in human strength. It would say, come to this place and get established. Come to this place and receive the strength of God. It's a beautiful idea here. So those were the great pillars there. There was another thing that he made there. If you look at verse 23, it talks about the sea of bronze. It says, and he made the sea of cast bronze, 10 cubits from one brim to the other. It was completely round. Its height was 5 cubits and a line of 30 cubits measured in its circumference. This was a huge basin of water used for the ceremonial washings associated with sacrifice. It was used by the priest for cleansing their hands and feet, and then also for rinsing off the offerings. It held something like 11,500 gallons, or you could say 43,500 liters. It was extremely big. It was connected with the ceremonial washings, again, of the temple. And so it was a magnificent thing right there in the middle of the temple area. And then on verse 48, it describes something else that they made. It says, thus Solomon had all the furnishings made for the house of the Lord, the altar of gold and the table of gold on which was the showbread. Now, if you remember, inside of the tabernacle were different pieces of furniture. It wasn't just an empty room. You would walk into the tabernacle, and on the left, you would see a menorah, a golden lampstand that would light the tabernacle because there was no natural source of light inside the tabernacle. By the way, it may very well be that there were natural sources of light coming into the temple. I can't say that with certainty, but some of the architectural reconstructions I have seen indicate that there may have been natural light coming into the temple, but that's impossible to know for certainty one way or another. But if you walked into the tabernacle, you'd see the menorah or the lampstand on this side. On your right side, you would see the table of showbread. This was a golden table upon which were, you could call them loaves. They were actually more like pieces of flat bread because that's what they would eat back then. But they were pieces or loaves of bread stacked upon a table that indicated the fellowship that God wanted to have with Israel. There were 12 lobes, one representing each tribe of Israel, and they had to be changed regularly because God wanted the fellowship with his people to be fresh. He didn't want it to be stale. And then right in front of you would be the altar of incense. The altar of incense was that place upon which burning coals were brought, and then incense was sprinkled, and it filled the whole tabernacle with the smell of incense. Now, when Solomon built the temple, he remade these important pieces of furniture, and he had this great craftsman remake them. And so he rebuilt the table of showbread. As a matter of fact, 2 Chronicles chapter 4, verse 8 tells us that they made 10 tables of showbread, not just one. Here they're collectively described as one, but 2 Chronicles makes it clear that there were actually 10 different tables of showbread. I don't know why 10. It seemed to me that you make 12. You know, if it's connected with the tribes of Israel, I don't know why, but for some reason Solomon made 10. And then all the great works of art and all the gold pieces and all the furnishings and all the beautiful things. It says here in verse 51, so all the work that King Solomon had done for the house of the Lord was finished. And Solomon brought in the things which his father David had dedicated, the silver and the gold and the furnishings. He put them in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. So all these great works of art and articles of great value were placed in the temple. This included the carts that they made, which are described there in chapter 7, the shovels, the bowls, and all the other needed utensils for sacrifice, and he brought in all the things that David had prepared. And so the work of the temple was finished. Now, our next time together, we're going to begin in chapter 8, and we're going to look at this magnificent time when Solomon dedicated the temple. But it's worth it for us to consider, again, the similarity between the way God wanted the temple built and the way that he works in your life. You know, God spares no expense, no trouble, no costly thing does he spare in building in your life. He wants to make you, as an individual, a beautiful temple, and so he works in your life that way. He's chipping away, isn't he? He's using the finest materials. He's fashioning according to the most skillful craftsman, and, might I say, he's working according to a plan. Do you feel sometimes that God's work in your life is almost, you know, haphazard, that he's making it up as it goes along? It just moves from one thing to another. Don't think that. He's working according to a plan, just as much as Solomon had a plan. And it was a plan prepared a long time in advance. God is working that in your individual life. But secondly, he's also doing it in the church. I have to say, sometimes I look at the body of Christ as a whole. Of course, we're very encouraged by what we see God doing around us and in our immediate midst. It's wonderful to see, and we're excited about it. You take a look at the body of Christ as a whole, and you wonder, if they were to transfer the condition of the body of Christ as a whole, let's say in Europe or in Germany, and take it, and if you were to transform it into the figure of a building, what would it look like? Would it look like a ruin? You know, would it look like a glorious thing like Solomon's temple? But you realize that God is building something precious out of that as well. There are times when it's more evident that it's doing that, but he's doing a glorious work of building nevertheless. But you know, he's shaping you right here so that you'll fit in properly up there in the temple. Don't despise that work. You are a dwelling place of the Spirit of God, just as much, or might I say, maybe even more so than that temple that Solomon built. This should give us great encouragement and say, Lord, keep doing your building work in me. I know you have a plan. I know you're using the right materials. I know you bring the best people along to do the work. Do your building work in me.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. There's a secure option to give right on the homepage of enduringword.com. You can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at enduringword.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.